So I want to move on with this discourse a little bit, and so we have another piece of paper. So I don't want, as we move on to another piece of paper, I'm really going to encourage you not to lose sight of this particular map. Because what we have here on this map that we've talked about so far is this is almost like the raw material of a quarrel. You know, this is the raw material that builds and that creates and recreates distress over and over again in our lives. So this is almost the building blocks of dukkha. So we think of dukkha or distress or argument or quarrel, something that's really dependent upon certain conditions being in place. And this, the anusyas, the distorted perceptions, the distorted views, are almost the building blocks of all of that distress. And the way that it obviously manifests most clearly for us is in the realm of papancha, the narrative. The narrative that almost gives a voice to the distortions of view and the distortions of perception. But I also want to remind you that of the backward motion of this, because the narrative serves the purpose of keeping those distortions in place. So this is also the raw materials of self-building and world-building. And when we come to papancha, the narrative, you know, I really, I don't know if ever, any of you have come across the book Into the Silent Land by Paul Brocks. He's a neuropsychologist who's actually spent his whole professional career trying to find if there really is a fixed, enduring self, and, you know, has come to the conclusion that there isn't. But what he says about papancha, he says, you know, this, we need to rethink this, because it's not as if we are telling the story of who we are. The story is telling us who we are. So this is really quite important to bear in mind, that the story is telling us who we are. So every time that story or the papancha is circulating, it's not only telling us who we are, you know, I'm sad, I'm defensive, I'm a failure. The story is also telling the world as it is. You know, you are like this, the world is like this. So the story is constantly reinforcing when it's rooted in these underlying tendencies. It's constantly reinforcing the distortions. So clearly the encouragement here is not to somehow seek some, you know, idyllic, naive place of no thought. You know, that's not the point here. The point is really recognizing where our thinking processes are actually being flavored by these underlying tendencies, which are in turn flavored by distortions of perception and view, and then how the story is actually delivering us a conclusion, often, about who we are, about how you are, about how the world is. So this is a kind of the building blocks of the argument. Is that clear for you? So then the Buddha goes on in the sutta to talk about how this is manifested as present moment process in a slightly different way, which is in this particular map. So I'd like to read you what the discourse says. First of all, start with a quote from the Buddha, because what we have here in the beginning of this chain is this word contact. Every moment of experience there is contact. We are always touching and being touched by the world, by the world of the sense doors. We're always touching and being touched. This is, in terms of world construction, this is a very crucial piece of understanding. The Buddha says, with contact, the world arises. With the cessation of contact, there is a cessation of the world. That the foolish seek to pursue contact, and the wise seek to understand it. And when he talks about the arising of the world and the cessation of the world, he's not talking about the disappearance of the objective world. He's talking about the arising of my personal world of experience, which is distorted, and the cessation of that distorted world of experience. Okay. So the contact is the beginning of a process of building a world of experience. Now, in a single day, there are thousands of moments of contact. Some of these are just passing, fleeting, fluid. They hardly register in our attention. And some of these moments of contacts indeed do begin to cross over into this map, template, and begin to build a world of experience. Okay, so I'm going to read you what the discourse says about this. Depending on the I and forms, I consciousness arises. The meeting of the three is contact. The meeting of the three is contact. This goes on through the suttas. Dependent on the ear and sounds, there is hearing. This is contact. Dependent on the nose and odors, there is smelling. There is contact. Depending on the body, sensation, there is sensing. That is contact. Dependent on the mind and mind objects, there is thinking or conjecturing. There is contact. So in Buddhist psychology, there are six sense doors. There are our usual five, and the mind is really regarded as the sixth sense door. Sixth sense doorway. So contact is the meeting of these three, the eye, the sight, and the seeing, the body, the sensation, and the sensing, the ear, the sound, and the hearing, the tongue, the taste, the tasting, okay? So the combination of these three is contact. Contact is the beginning of a building process. So the sutta says, with contact as condition, there is feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one proliferates about. What one proliferates about as the source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person with respect to past, future, and present. You got that? I'll read it again. With contact as condition, there is feeling. That which one feels, one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates about. With what one has mentally proliferated about, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person with respect to past, future, and present forms. This is really where we move into very present moment process. Okay, so it's about present moment process that we can track and that we can trace in our own experience. My eyes meet the sight and there's seeing. This is just bare material. That is contact. There is a feeling tone to that sight. It's either going to be pleasant or it's unpleasant or it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. What we feel, we perceive. I label the sight. Oh, it's a deer. What I perceive, I begin to proliferate about. oh, isn't it wonderful? There's so many deer around here. Or, you know, if like me, you've had Lyme's disease in the past, you say, oh, there's a tick carrier, you know, and you know, you begin to proliferate about, you know, I'm going to hang out more here in the woods, you know, I'm going to catch sight of some more deer, you know, I'll bring my deer book, you know, or, oh, no, there's another deer, I better be careful, you know, there might be ticks in the grass, you know, and why are there so many deer here? You know, it's time to have a call, you know, who's got precedence here, the deer or my health, you know. What we proliferate about, we dwell upon. We start to contract around. We dwell upon. With the perception and the proliferation, we begin to draw into this process the underlying tendencies which are rooted in the basic distortions. What we dwell upon, this means we're frequently kind of identifying with, we're dwelling upon, we're you know, proliferating about, becomes the shape of our mind. Becomes the shape of our mind. Oh, my mind's so delighted, it's so happy, you know, it's so spacious, I love being in nature. Oh, the shape of the mind is so contracted, so hypervigilant, you know, so aversive. Becomes the shape of the mind. The shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world. This process happens so quickly. We move from contact into a mind shape in seconds. Nanoseconds even. We don't even know how we got there. The practice, of course, is to slow down this process and to begin to investigate it. When there is a manifestation of contact, it's possible to point out the manifestation of feeling. When there's a manifestation of feeling, it's possible to point out the manifestation of perception. When there's a manifestation of perception, it's possible to point out the manifestation of thinking. Then it's possible to point out the manifestation of being beset. This is the point where we begin to suffer, being beset by perceptions and notions tinged by proliferation. Okay, so we need to just unpack this a little bit, if we can. Excuse me, I'm just finding the right piece of paper. You're going to say I'm beset by paper. I don't actually really need it. So, what we're going to actually look at here now, contact is ethically neutral. You know, there's no implications to contact whatsoever. As long as we're living, moving, sensing human beings, there is going to be contact. There's a very key feature in here, which is this term at the top, Yanaso Manasakara, which means skillful or wise or appropriate attention, and ayanaso manasakara, which is unskillful or unwise or unhelpful attention. Now, contact stimulates an attentiveness, doesn't it? One of our sense doors wakes up. Our eyes wake up, or our mind wakes up, or our body wakes up, because there is a condition for that to wake up. There is a sensory object. So contact is quite ethically neutral. It's nothing. It's how we attend that turns it into something else. Whether it's skillful or unskillful, helpful or unhelpful, is going to be determined whether we bring wise, skillful, or unwise or unskillful attention to it. So what we contact, we feel. Now this is. Contact and feeling and perception, you know, are pretty much simultaneous arisings, you know. Now, in terms of Buddhist psychology, every moment of contact has a feeling tone. This is pre-verbal. It's like if you stroke the back of your hand. You know, it's kind of pre-verbal that feels quite pleasant. If a stranger on a bus stroked the back of my hand, it probably would be quite unpleasant. So every single sensory impression, every moment of contact, it makes an imprint on consciousness as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Now, in the terms of world construction and self-construction, from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, this feeling point is the weakest point in the whole constructing process. It's the weakest point in the whole constructing process. The capacity to bring mindfulness and wise attention to the point of contact and feeling may very well determine whether we enter into hell or heaven in any given moment. Now, this pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, some of this is actually objective. According to Buddhist psychology, there's a very, very small number of sensory experiences that are either implicitly pleasant or implicitly unpleasant, particularly implicitly unpleasant. You know, a broken leg for all of us would hurt, would be unpleasant. You know, grief hurts. You know, there is in the whole description of dukkha, there is the pain of pain. You know, there are times when the body just hurts and the mind just hurts. And it's got nothing to do with my subjective view of it. It's simply the impression that is made. The vast majority of our sense of feeling tones is quite subjective. Why is something pleasant to me and the same thing unpleasant to you? Why is something pleasant to me in one moment and the same thing unpleasant to me in the next moment? You know, you're sitting and you're quite having a very difficult, restless sitting. The sound of the bell is so pleasant. You're sitting, you know, even before you register it as the sound of the bell, there's the out-breath, you know. If you're sitting and you feel you're on the brink of some great startling revelation and the bell goes, it's unpleasant. We actually really don't question that much, because it's at this point of contact and feeling and then perception what gets drawn in are the underlying tendencies and the distorted perceptions. This is the point where we actually invest feeling tones into an object or an experience. That's so nice, that's so terrible, you know, that feels good, that feels so bad, you know, that's implicitly awful, that's implicitly, you know, beautiful. This is the point where contact, feeling, and perception are interacting to create our world of the moment. Can you sense that in your experience? So the encouragement in Buddhist teaching and meditative training is let's take these first three really seriously. Let's take these first three really seriously. Let's start to discern the difference between wise attention and unwise attention. A wise attention in Buddhist psychology is not grasping at the sense impression or the associations with it. So the sight is the sight, the sound is the sound. Not as I've heard it before or plan to hear it in the future. I see the sound is the sound, the sensation is the sensation. To learn actually what is unwise attention is grasping at the sense impression and the associations with it. The pleasant means, oh, I'm going to feel so good, you know, and I'm going to plan to feel more good, and, you know, how am I going to keep this going, and, you know, this feels unpleasant, I feel so bad, you know, it made me unhappy last week, it's going to make me unhappy next week, you know, and I can't possibly bear how it feels in the present, you know. Beset a person in regard to the past, the present, and the future. So we're learning our capacity to develop wise attention really in these first three links. What we perceive, we think about. You can see that happening, dependent on the feeling tone and how the feeling tone is related to. What we perceive, we think about. What we think about, we proliferate about. The thought, the story starts going. What we proliferate about, we dwell upon. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. It's never too late. Oh, it's also bearing in mind that the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world. I mean, that's the next step. You know, that's a kind of obvious one. So it's never actually too late in any of this process to bring wise attention. You know, you're not always going to be so mindfully present at the point of contact and feeling. You know, and perception, you know, because this happens immediately. It happens so quickly. You know, you cannot defend against it. You cannot protect against it. This is simply what is going on in every waking and even sleeping moment. It's most likely we're going to actually, well, if we can bring wise attention to the feeling tone, this is a huge practice element and makes a huge difference. This is where we kind of short-circuit the process, you know, of beginning to think about, dwell upon, proliferate about, shaping the mind. This is where there's often a sense of choice and a sense of capacity, you know. And when you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, which many of you will be familiar with, the ways of establishing mindfulness, this is the kind of instruction that is carried through the entire thing, you know, to know a feeling as a feeling, to know the body as the body, to know a sight as a sight, a thought as a thought. It's a constant reminder to develop here this capacity for skillful attention, which short circuits the proliferation process, short circuits the identification process, short circuits the association process, allows us to be responsive, allows us to see things anew, and the mind is not shaped then by the drawing in of this raw material of the argument. But you might actually, you know, not be so present there. You might notice the proliferating tendency, as I mentioned earlier. This is not hard to spot, you know, how much time we spent lost in thought. You know, just lost in thought. We might begin to actually, you know, start to be mindful of the fact that this is not really the only way to live, is being lost in thought and these streams of papancha. We might actually find that there's ways of coming out of being lost in papancha, you know, and finding ground and finding that simplicity again. So it's not too late simply because, you know, this process has moved on into this proliferating papancha. You start to dwell upon, this is where things start to repeat, where we start to obsess, where we start to ruminate, you know, where we find ourselves feeling more and more imprisoned, you know, and then this becomes a shape of the mind. Becomes a shape of the mind. This is actually really not a very complex chain, you know, in a sense. It's not a complex process. What makes it so very, very difficult to see is because all of this keeps getting drawn in into this point of feeling and perception. And that's actually what confuses us and turns us into this complex process where we ask, how did I end up here and how do I get out of here? How do I get out of this stuck or this contracted place that I'm in? You know, this sense of being in tension or in an argument with the way things actually are. So this is, you know, contact, feeling, perception is a point where we start to short-circuit these sort of background conditions that are the conditions for proliferation, and the afflictions that beset a person. Perfectly clear. You can trace this, you can see this. It's good to imprint this map, you know. It's really good to imprint. I find it really helpful to sort of imprint this map into moments of contact, you know, to actually sort of have it as a sort of visible template, you know, in our mind, to actually imprint it and say, you know, well, actually, what's going on here? You know, how did we end, you know, what is the process that's brought us to here? It's not actually about backtracking, but it's actually starting to develop the sensitivity, I think, and the mindfulness that brings us to these places of contact, feeling, perception. It's because this is where my world starts. And, you know, the quarrel is, of course, that my world is quite distinct from your world.
Is the difference between proliferation and dwelling upon just a matter of time?
This is all a matter of intensification, yes. These are not kind of separated, discrete steps. This is a process. Okay, and it's a process of intensification, a process of magnification. Absolutely. And that's coming in with contact, feeling, and perception, you know, because once we have a sort of name for the deer or, you know, whatever, that's opening the door into that sort of past experience and association, which is why we see the past keeps getting almost recreated in the present, and then when it's recreated in the present, it gets recreated in the future. You know, so it's this moment of constantly drawing on the same body of information, as you say, your past experience with it. You're constantly drawing on the same body of information, so that body of information gets superimposed upon that moment of contact and feeling. Well, how the feeling tone comes in is quite mysterious, isn't it? Why it's pleasant in one moment and unpleasant in another moment.
It seems like, I don't know if there's two different types of feeling. You can talk about this contact is going to generate feeling in the sense of awareness of that contact, right? But it seems like it's perception, maybe proliferation, and bringing in the enunciation and stuff that generates the feeling tone.
I mean, it's a two-way street here. It's not just one way. You know, very often, you know, we might be in one of the distortions or one of the underlying tendency, and that's going to determine how something imprints as a feeling tone.
Because that's already present.
So we're actually making contact through the eyes of that anusya. You know, so then that anusya is already determining, as you say, whether that feeling tone is going to be pleasant or unpleasant in the moment of contact. You know, say you're kind of lost in the anusya of aversion, you know, as a mind state and as a pattern, you know, and then you're walking through the world, you know, and you're making contact with sights and sounds and tastes and touches, and that present sense, present manifestation of that tendency is going to be determining how that is experienced as being unpleasant. So it's really a two-way street. This is a very fluid process. I mean, certainly in the Buddhist teaching, you know, feeling is such a sort of significant place because feeling tones tend and perceptions tend to directly tap into the anusyas when there's unskillful attention, You know, so the unpleasant immediately taps into aversion, you know, or doubt, or you know, all of those kind of feelings. Whereas the pleasant immediately taps into craving and wanting more of, you know, and that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant just immediately taps into the inertia of ignorance, of actually just not knowing what's going on. And
how does, like, wise attention to that feeling tone?
Because you're learning to strip the feeling tone of the associations that are tied in with both the inertias and the perceptions.
So somehow that wise attention, there's some part of that process where you're, I mean, you're not trying to change the feeling tone.
No, you're not trying to change the feeling tone. But the feeling tone might very well change in the light of wise attention. You know, it might very well change, because after obviously unwise attention is keeping a particular feeling tone really in place and seen as being implicit in the object rather than in the perception. So sometimes it might change and sometimes it might not change. You know, the unpleasant may stay unpleasant, particularly if it's within the realm of the, you know, the level of unpleasant that I spoke about as being quite objective. You know, the broken leg is not going to start feeling good. But the deer may actually become just a deer.
And somehow the proliferation of aversion
stops. So many what? Well, but in Western psychology, we tend to translate Vedana as a feeling, as emotion. Emotion in Buddhist psychology is a far more complex construction. In fact, there isn't a word in Pali for emotion, because it is such a compound process that involves feeling, it involves association, it involves the body. You know, it involves thinking. So there isn't actually a word in Pali for emotion, because it's just one of those processes that's got solidified. Whereas feeling in Buddhist psychology, and I think this is why people make things way too hard for themselves, it's really simple. You know, it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. But what makes it complex is when those feeling tones are then opening the door in the light of unwise attention into the inusias. And that's where the proliferation starts, the dwelling starts, you know, the shape of the mind starts to be formed and the shape of the world starts to be formed.
You mentioned that in our experience of the world, there's thousands of, I guess, like sense data, but we only make contact with certain ones. And would it be right to say that the attention plays a role in that as well, as to what we actually make contact with, not just the feeling tone?
So the question is around, you know, in any given moment, there's thousands of sensory impressions, and actually what determines what we make contact with. Well, sometimes that's in the level of attention, that is, something has just simply become more predominant than anything else, you know.
Yeah.
Like if we sat here and somebody slammed the door, we would all, you know, suddenly wake up to that. At other times, what determines what we make contact with is actually because our attention is being guided by the inusias. You know? So we're actually going to the world, out through the world looking, you know, if there's greed there or lesser, we're going out to the world looking for what's actually going to somehow, you know, please us or excite us or you know, stimulate us. If there's aversion present, we're probably going to be out there looking at the world through those lens. So we'll probably see the weeds in the garden rather than the blooms,
right.
You know?
On the other hand, if we bring, I guess, the yonaso manasikara, the attention that's motivated by an intention of renunciation or non-cruelty stuff, then our contacts are going to be very different.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, going back to that, you know, that what I started with on contact, our world arises, you know, with the cessation of contact, there's a cessation of the world. The foolish pursue contact. So the foolish are actually so delighting in their inusias you know, that they're looking for the raw information to serve those anusyas, even when those anusyas are painful. You know, if I'm sort of living in an underlying pattern of doubt, you know, I'm probably going to, on edge. My eyes are going to be looking out for, you know, who's going to give me negative feedback. You know, so even though the tendency is so painful, it's still sort of so entrancing that it's determining how, what I will make contact with. I won't see the person who's maybe smiling at me in the corner. And I'll be looking at the person, looking out for the one who's frowning. Sorry?
What about depression?
Well, depression is a shape of mind. Depression is a shape of mind. You know, the shape of mind is made up of, you know, what it, it's almost like the how the mind is, yeah, how the mind is being shaped, you know? So depression is a shape of mind. Now, there's much behind that shape of mind, isn't there? There's certainly a lot of proliferation in the form of rumination. Rumination is the supporting condition of depression. It's the supporting condition of depression. Now, that rumination that supports the depression, you know, it's pretty easy to identify the anusyas that actually support that rumination, isn't it? I mean, certainly, in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, you know, this is where the practice is really focused, is on cutting through the rumination, because that is a supporting factor, both of present depression and relapse depression, is an ordinary, unpleasant thought to someone who is, you know, doesn't have a history of depression, just goes right on through, whereas someone who's got a history of depression, just the arising of what is an ordinary, unpleasant thought becomes a trigger for rumination. You know, that this is a signal of relapse, and it's a signal of the return of the depression. So this is, you know, where mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is actually cutting the link, is at the proliferation level. Yes, yes, yes.
I couldn't hear the question.
The question was about the nature of depression and how it fits into this chain, and it's, you know, it's really the shape of the mind that's being supported by the proliferating factor, but the very the history of a thought just can re-trigger depression. We certainly need to have some filters, you know, and I think what the anusyas does is actually removes filters. You know, I think the anusyas, the underlying patterns, make the mind incredibly vulnerable to the world of sensory impression. And the filter is mindfulness. Even though it's another one of those words I'd like to put in the recycle bin. But the filter is actually the training of the mind of learning how to attend, you know, with a sense of collectedness, with a sense of focus, you know, not just this kind of wide open mind, you know, just bombard me, you know. It's actually that sense of, and a lot of that is really tied in with intention about choosing where we attend and how. It certainly needs those filters. That's part of it. That's a big part of it. Is cleansing the perception doors, you know, and that's why it's never too late. But that has to go hand in hand with skillful and wise attention of how we attend to the moment. I mean, and this also has many other factors in it, isn't it? This is where we really get that familiarity with our mind. For example, if the shape of our mind feels very restless and agitated, it would just be foolishness to actually go out into the world and say, bring it on, you know? It's actually, that's the moment where we would actually see, no, what is really needed here is a little bit more simplicity, a little bit more collectedness. You know, if the shape of our mind is one that's really contracted, you know, knowing that shape of the mind would actually alter the kind of attention we bring, that we actually need to be bringing in more information to bring more spaciousness. So Yanasara Manaskara is not about concentration. It's not about concentration. Wise attention is not about concentration. It's about how we're attending and how we're learning to attend without grasping at the sense impression and the associations with it. Well, you know, I think that's part of the picture. You know, I think part of developing wise attention is developing a dialogue and a relationship with the content of what's going on. But the object is not to create a sort of distance, you know, an observing distance. The object is really to foster an understanding. You know, and I think part of it is really, you know, there's so much that's being undone here in what we're talking about, isn't it, in terms of the magnetism of our proliferation. You know, I mean, I saw a bumper sticker recently where it says, "Of course I talk to myself. I'm always looking for expert advice." You know, I mean, that's a kind of classic one. Of course I talk to myself. I'm always looking to get my views and my... you know, recharged and reinstated and reified, you know. So, I mean, I think part of mindfulness is to beginning to establish a dialogue and a relationship with what's going on. But that's not the end goal, is to have an observing center. You know, the end goal is to use that as a skillful means to begin to understand processes of construction. Because we're not just trying to create another kind of a sense almost of distance, but enough space to be able to explore and slow down this process as it arises.
One thought was, if there's another point of contact at the proliferation level, where I might notice that I've thought of something 20 times and it doesn't feel very good, and you guys just start to notice, like, get a little bit untangled from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can come in at any point here, you know. I mean, proliferation, as I said earlier this morning, is really obvious, our most obvious alarm signal, you know. When we're starting to repeat, go in circles with our thinking, you know, we ought to look at this as an alarm bell, you know, rather than something to be holding to or reinforcing or feeding, you know, because, you know, you don't proliferate, as I mentioned earlier, about, you know, when the mind is spacious, when the mind is calm, when the mind is collected, when we're not leaking, we don't proliferate. We proliferate when there's leaking. So it's a point where it's actually really important to be able to stop and say, what is actually going on here?
I wonder about that. The Yoni So Manasikara, I was told once that the etymology, like it like birth, like it's like the moment that it's actually. And so is the investigation to go back to, like, so wherever you start in this chain of construction, to trace it back, or not necessarily?
I mean, I think there's limited value in that, you know, because that's often starting off a new process of proliferation. I think there's sometimes a limited value in tracing back a process to where it started, you know. Where did that proliferation begin? You know, what was the point of contact? I think there's very limited value to that, you know, because it's usually just starting off another thought chain. I think it's actually okay, here is proliferation, where is the end of proliferation? Not through finding a cause of it, but through finding a response to it.
So in the proliferation, there's a contact there too, I guess.
Yeah, that's the mind making contact with the thought chain.
So then that would be the inquiry.
That would be the inquiry, yeah. I think when thoughts are arising, to ask the question, you know, is this helpful, is this truthful, is this kind? That would get rid of an awful lot of thoughts, wouldn't it? The mind would cut a lot quieter. The term reify, to make something solid. To make something solid. I mean, you know, if you think about a lot of what we've talked about in terms of proliferation and dwelling and the tendencies, they're making something solid, aren't they? Reifying is when we're going from process mode into state and noun mode. The I am, the you are, this sense of solidifying. Yeah.
So we have this process you just talked about. How would you incorporate more focus on the lovely?
The lovely, part of the lovely is actually cultivating our capacity to notice this and to cultivate non-clinging in the midst of this. I mean, there's a word in Buddhist psychology which you know, is not, usually not very welcome in Western cultures because it sounds negative, but it's disenchantment. It's disenchantment, you know. And disenchantment is not about rejection or aversion. It's losing the enchantment, the interest in that which doesn't serve us well. You know, disenchantment is to do, you know, when the Buddha talks about there's nothing here to delight in, there's nothing here to welcome, there's nothing here to cling to. That's actually disenchantment, you know. I'm kind of losing interest in this particular story, you know, or in this particular anusya. You know, I'm kind of losing interest in it, you know. There's a loss of interest in it through actually seeing it for what it is. Reify, R-E-I-F-Y, reification.
Okay, thank you.
R-E-I-F-Y.
Often when we hit that point of proliferation, as you mentioned, it just happens really quickly, and all of a sudden you've got whatever, you've got a distress, or you've got some stress feeling or fear or whatever. And, you know, I mean, I can go like, oh, wow, I can feel that I'm contracting. I can feel that this is happening. I can feel that this is, you know, faith in fear, this is illogical. But it's so hard once you hit that point to find, as you said, ways of, other ways of, or ways of releasing it, or, sorry, I can't remember exactly how you put it. So I've been going back to the story. But how do you do that? You know, when you're caught up in that moment, is it possible to do it, or is it something more that you should be practicing from the start?
Mentioning how the challenge of extricating ourselves from proliferation. And, you know, it's so true, you know. And, you know, you're probably going to be very well ill-equipped unless you've actually trained yourself to do so. You know, I mean, I quite love that statement of John Kabat-Zinn where he says, you know, the time to weave your parachute is not when you're about to jump out of the plane. You know, so, you know, we are talking about a process here of training the mind, as we said yesterday. We're training the mind to non-proliferate, you know, and there's many aspects to that, you know, developing our attentional capacities, you know, developing mindfulness. You know, there's many, many ways in which we're actually training the mind in non-distress. You know, and we're called. You know, it's like in the sutta here when the Buddha says, you know, with contact as a condition, there is feeling. With feeling as a condition, there is perception. With perception as a condition. So, you know, there's certain conditions in place that incline the mind towards being lost in proliferation. You know, when I've spoken about cultivating the lovely, we're actually cultivating the conditions that don't incline the mind towards the proliferation, but that incline the mind towards seeing clearly, to be able to attend skillfully. And that's what, you know, that's why it's a path, and that's why it's a practice, and that's why it's a cultivation, you know. And, you know, if we don't have that training, you know, we're pretty ill-equipped in moments of papancha storms to know how to extricate ourselves from it. Because, you know, it doesn't mean if the well-trained mind never has a papancha storm, but it has resources. It can ask, what does this moment need? You know, do I need to take my attention somewhere else? You know, do I need to cultivate the lovely? Do I need to actually, you know, cultivate more one-pointedness? Do I actually bring in more metta, more of that intention? You know, so, you know, it's actually about, you know, training the mind is actually resourcing inwardly, you know, for meeting the moments of contact, for meeting the moments of perception in ways that we're not creating the conditions for proliferation to happen. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's a good time for us to stop for lunch now. It's 12 o'clock.